Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 7th of January. First hour of our program today, we're going to be talking about Yemen. The reasons are obvious. The December person who wanted to bomb the United States, Abdul Muttalib, may have been trained in Yemen. And there is concern, of course, now about how large terrorism may be in that country. And it's another part of the world that we probably didn't know very much about, those of us who live here. And our understanding will be deepened as a result of this first hour. Our guest is Professor Charles Schmitz. He is a professor in the Department of Geography at Towson University in Baltimore, Maryland, and happens to be a specialist on Yemen. His interests include the political economy of development and development policy in the Arab world, international law, the war on terror, contemporary geopolitics, and the issue of the failing state. He teaches geography of the Middle East, economic geography, human geography, world regional geography, and other courses. And his recent publications include Yemeni Reflections on Guantanamo and American Efforts for Political Reform in the Arab World, The Legal Battle for Guantanamo and Cooperation and Conflict, Analyzing the U.S.-Yemen Relationship. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Professor Schmitz. Our phone number, as always, is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And you can send us an email if you'd like to do that. That address, talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Professor Schmitz, thank you so much for being with us today. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me on your show.
Yeah. Tell me, how did you become an expert in Yemen?
How did I become an expert in Yemen?
Yeah.
I was a graduate student, and when I was getting ready to go out for my research, one of my advisors said, oh, you should go to Yemen. I had been intending to go to Egypt. And she said, no, Yemen's the place to go. And so I went. She had all kinds of contacts, and I went, and she was right. I enjoyed it very much.
Hmm. So Yemen was the place to go. Why was that?
That was back in the 90s, in the early 90s, when Yemen had just unified. In 1990, it unified the north and the south. And the Americans hadn't been in the south. The south was a Soviet satellite state. And she had some contacts in the South, and so I went to do some research on the transition in the South from a socialist to a market economy in the agricultural sector.
Mm-hmm.
Fascinating. It was really great.
Is there a large segment of al-Qaeda in Yemen?
A large segment of al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda, I've seen various estimates, maybe 200, maybe 300 fighters, something like that, inside of Yemen right now. I don't know the numbers for example, Pakistan or Somalia. It kind of depends on what you mean by al-Qaeda. I think, you know, there are many different sort of functions and people that are loosely related, so depending on exactly what we're counting.
Mm-hmm. So when you would look, would you say that we're looking at other organizations, not by the name of al-Qaeda, functioning in Yemen?
When you say organization, what do you mean?
Other terror organizations.
Terror organizations, okay. I would say that in terms of terror, al-Qaeda is the specialist in it. It's probably the only one. It's the only one I know of inside of Yemen.
And Abdul Muttalib had an association with Yemen. Do we know very much about what that was?
There's a thing in the news this morning that the interior or the foreign minister said that they somehow had confirmed that he had met with Awlaki, who was the guy from New Mexico who was in Shabwa in Yemen. So it appears that there is confirmation that he had a relationship with al-Qaeda in Yemen.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you about the relationship of Yemen and the United States in fighting terror subsequent to 9/11. I started the show talking about a visit to Washington on the part of the president of Yemen, and there was a deal signed here. There was conversation about how Yemen would cooperate with the United States.
Yeah. The Yemeni, it's a complex situation. Yemen was divided. It was a Cold War front. There was a north and a south. And in the north, they sent many fighters to Afghanistan to fight the Soviets.
Hmm.
In the Arab world, the militant Islamic revivalists of all different sorts were encouraged to against the left, because in the 50s and the 60s in the Arab world, the left was dominant in the Arab nationalist countries, sort of a left of center orientation, a secular Arab nationalist orientation. As the Islamist groups and the legitimacy of Islamic politics grew in the opposition, many of the younger, you know, more militant groups were encouraged and sent off to fight the left, either inside of the Arab world or in Afghanistan. And the Afghanistan, of course, where the United States basically did the same tactics, supporting the Mujahideen against the Soviets. There were lots of North Yemenis that went off to do this. When they came back to Yemen, they began to focus on the south, which is, of course, was a communist country. It was a Soviet satellite country. There was a campaign of assassinations of socialist leaders. The Islamists were encouraged in their fight against the communists, because, of course, the communists are godless. They're considered atheists. After the unification, the two governments, they came together and they had elections, and they, you know, the press was free, and they decided that they were going to use liberal democracy in order to choose a new leadership. But the Southerners felt somewhat betrayed. They felt like there were agreements that were made before the unity that were broken after unity, and they felt rather marginalized in the national politic. And some of them, along with some Southern nationalists, began saying that they needed to secede and reform a Southern government. They tried to do this in the spring of 1994, and there was a civil war. And in that war, the northern regime, which is now the main regime, the only regime of Yemen, used these fighters, and they were very important in the northern. They were one part of the northern victory over the south. Then, after the civil war, the president looked around. The Socialist Party and the Socialists had been the biggest danger to the president's rule. They were the most organized. Had been the former leaders of a state, and so politically they were his biggest challenge. After the defeat of them in the Civil War of 1994, the next biggest challenge was the Islamists. So the Islamists went from being his ally to his enemy, and he moved against them. There were legal Islamist parties that had been in a coalition with the president before the Civil War and just after the Civil War. He began to distance from them, and he forced them into opposition. On the military front, those fighters that had fought with the northern forces against the south, he gave them three choices. You either lay down your weapons and go home, you join me in my security apparatus, where, of course, I can keep a close watch on you, or we go to war and I kill you. And all three happened. Yemen started fighting. There were those that took up arms against the regime of the president. And there was fighting in 1995, fighting in 1996. Some of them joined his security forces. Some famous ones joined his security forces, where he could, of course, keep close watch on them. And others went home. So in that sense, the Yemeni government began a war on Islamic extremists who were going to violently oppose his regime in the mid-1990s.
Mm-hmm.
The United States, after unity, began to build a relationship with Yemen. Prior to the 1990s, the United States government didn't have much of an independent relationship with Yemen. We have an embassy there and whatnot, but we largely followed what the Saudis, because the Saudis are the dominant power in the region. We largely followed what the Saudis did. We followed the Saudi lead. But in the 90s, the United States started developing an independent relationship with Yemen. And there was a thought that we could build a military relationship. And in fact, what was his General Zinni, I think his name was, he started in the 90s promoting a military relationship with Yemen. That was begun partially with the refueling of ships in Aden Harbor. of American warships in Aden Harbor. And that is, of course, how the USS Cole was attacked
in
October 2000. That was part of an attempt by the United States to build a military alliance with them. And after that, the United States pulled out and decided not to do that. I think our main forces are in Djibouti now for the region. So that fell apart. But once the Cole bombing happened, then it brought the Yemeni-American relationship to a new level. And there we began to run into some problems. And the difficulty is that the United States sees the Yemeni government with suspicion. It is not sure of the intentions of the Yemeni government, and it sometimes thinks that the Yemeni government is either hiding things or not sincere in what it says, these sorts of things. The Yemeni government, for its part, is somewhat distrustful of the American government because it also thinks that the United States has intentions such as in controlling the region or imposing itself on the region or other sorts of things, and doesn't respect Yemeni sovereignty. A big, big issue here is the question of Yemeni sovereignty. The Yemenis are big on, Yemeni, as many former, countries of the Third World are. They're very wary of superpowers trying to impose their will. And so the Yemeni government and the Yemeni people are, They are very cautious about the involvement of foreign powers, and particularly the United States, inside of Yemen.
So the suspicions on the part of both countries are legitimate?
Yes, I would say so. It begins with the Cole bombing. When the Cole bombing happened, the FBI came in to do an investigation. There was lots of friction between the Yemeni and some of the investigators that came in. The investigators wanted to run their own investigation and sort of run the investigation, have direct access and interrogate Yemeni detainees. And the Yemeni security said, well, actually this is our country and you are not, you don't have jurisdiction here. This is our jurisdiction. And there was quite a bit of friction. And it took a conversation between President Clinton at the time and the President, Ali Abdullah Saleh, in order to straighten that out. There was cooperation, but there was sort of, at the same time, mutual suspicion between
yes.
the two sides on this. And then when 9/11 happened, there was talk in Washington, I remember it, that, after Afghanistan, the next country that we will invade is Yemen. I don't quite know, that was sort of inside the Beltway talk, and I don't know quite where it came from or why, because it doesn't make much sense at all. But immediately the president, as you mentioned in the introduction, went to Washington, where he, assured the president that he would cooperate, and there was a new level of cooperation. I know that FBI and other interrogators went to Yemen, and they went through some of the Yemeni prisons where Yemeni government had some detainees that the Americans were interested in, and that the Americans interviewed them extensively after 9/11.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back for just a moment before we take phone calls. Why was there even a movement toward unification? Who was behind that? It sounds like we were dealing with two very different populations, different philosophies. Who wanted them together?
Yemen is very interesting in that you can find everything there. You have socialists, and you have Islamists, and you have liberal Democrats, and you have all kinds of people. Yemen's a very, very interesting country in that sense. The movement towards unity happened basically because the southern economy failed. It is a very poor country. Its main export historically has been people. There are Yemenis in Detroit. There are Yemenis in California. There's Yemenis in East Africa. There's Yemenis in Indonesia and Malaysia, in India. In the period of the Cold War, after OPEC and the oil boom and the construction boom in the Gulf states, the Yemenis basically got up and left from both states, the north and the south. They went out and working, and the economies lived off of worker remittances. then, as in the mid-1980s, when that began to fall off, the North found oil and started exporting oil, and so they were on good footing. But in the South, there was no oil. The Soviets were trying desperately to find oil, and actually they did find oil, but they couldn't develop it quick enough to give the South income to be able to support itself when Gorbachev started to pull out of the Third World. And so the South Yemenis, they knew that they had no future. They had also blown themselves up. They had, in 1986, a very famous January a battle in Aden, where two factions of the Yemeni Socialist Party went at each other's neck and killed tens of thousands of people. So they, you know, they had already sort of committed political suicide, and they were just hanging on by their teeth. And so when they saw their economy collapsing, they went to the North and said, "Hey, let's work this out. Let's put together." Yemeni unity had always been very popular. There had always been a movement for Yemeni unity. Among people and among the politicians, there had been discussions. They had gotten together and agreed on Yemeni unity 20 years earlier, but it had never been a political reality until 1990. And then, because of the economic and political changes, the South kind of went running to the North and said, "Let's get together."
We're going to welcome phone calls. Our guest this hour is Professor Charles Schmitz. He's a professor of geography at Towson University in Baltimore, president of the American Institute of Yemeni Studies, and a specialist on Yemen. We'll move into other discussions here, too, talking more about the presence of al-Qaeda in Yemen, the decision by the president not to repatriate those prisoners who are held at Guantanamo to Yemen, and how that may forestall the closing of Guantanamo. What that means, is that a good decision or not? Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. Lines are open for you right now, 800-486-8655. Or you can send an email. The email is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunham. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program this Thursday, a delightful book about Harry Truman titled Harry Truman's Excellent Adventure, The True Story of a Great American Road Trip. It's a trip that he took along with his wife Bess in 1953, the summer following his departure from the presidency. He packed up his new Chrysler and undertook a journey that millions of Americans make every year, the cross-country road trip. He went from his hometown of Independence, Missouri, across the Midwest into Maryland, went into Washington, New York City, and it was an ill-fated attempt at anonymity. It's a lovely book because it talks about his policies and his presidency and disagreements with Eisenhower, Nixon, and others. So that's our number two. We go to phone calls for our guest, Professor Charles Schmitz. We're looking at Yemen this hour of the program and welcoming your calls, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Mike from Appleton is our first caller. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, good morning. Geography matters, Professor. As an expert in the subject, I'd like to ask him his thoughts on how does he perceive the difference between, let's say, the Bush administration and the Obama administration as to their focus on terrorism? Because, I mean, with this recent incident that happened in Detroit, every possible red flag that could have existed in this particular case existed. I mean, the guy's father even called us and said, "Hey, he's going to do something," and yet nothing happened. And I just simply like to make a statement. You know, the number one job of the president of the United States and his administration is to protect the country. And so, therefore, Mr. President, I suggest you forget the rest of the crud and concentrate on protecting us. Thank you.
Thanks, Mike.
Let me just say a little bit about that. In terms of Yemen, the important thing, the thing that people are talking about right now inside of Yemen, is that all of a sudden the whole world has woken up to Yemen because this guy, this Nigerian guy, comes in with a bomb on a plane. But Yemen's been facing very, very serious problems for a number of years now, and they will probably not ease up for some time. And when the United States comes to Yemen, we've had a relationship for some time with the Yemenis. It's very important that both sides benefit from the relationship. And so, you know, the Yemeni have been, and recently have been very strident in fighting al-Qaeda. They were fighting al-Qaeda before. There was an attack on the U.S. Embassy in 2008. There was an attack on some Spanish tourists in 2007. And al-Qaeda has, you know, occasionally attacked oil installations and whatnot. These are vital interests for the Yemenis. They've attacked the Yemeni government. They killed some security officers. And the Yemeni government has been pretty good at tracking down cells. They've gotten quite a few of them, and right now they're going through, and there's like 3,000 troops that are dedicated to nothing but going after al-Qaeda folks in different parts of the country. You know, within Yemen, you hear this, you hear a lot of talk about, you know, well, we've got, you know, 40 or 45% of people below the poverty level, you know, we have a very serious political crisis. That's a huge problem within inside of Yemen. That's part of the thing that's contributing to the presence of al-Qaeda there. Al-Qaeda is exploiting that political crisis. And people say, well, you know, it's great the United States wants us to chase down al-Qaeda, but we have some very big problems of our own. And so, you know, if the United States wants from us to chase down al-Qaeda, you know, we need help in other realms as well. And I think to the Obama administration's credit, they realize this. I think a lot of people realize this, not just Obama, but the Europeans realize this, and I think the Gulf realizes this as well. And so I think there is now much more regional cooperation to come in and solve, you know, some of the political and the economic issues that serve as a background, that serve very much as a fertile ground for the cultivation of al-Qaeda. And I think the fight in al-Qaeda has got to be a multi-pronged fight in Yemen, and it's got to be one that is, you know, a cooperative relationship between the United States and Yemen.
So those realms deal mostly with poverty, with jobs, with what?
A big part is economic. As I said, the big issue there is that the economy for the last 15 years has relied very heavily on petroleum, and petroleum is running out. And so Yemen has to move to a more diversified economy. They do have some of the resources, but none of them are going to replace the central role that oil has. The key thing about this is that the government of Yemen has to play an important role in sort of directing a more diversified economy and providing an environment in which you can get development, in which you can get investment, and cooperating with the Gulf states, and we need their cooperation very, very much, to open their doors to Yemeni workers to go into the Gulf states to earn income, you know, the Yemeni government has got to be much more, how do I say it, they have to build institutions. They have to be much more able to build the kind of environment in which in the economy works. They haven't been very good at that. Institution building has not been one of their fortes. And that's the big fear. So there are all those big economic issues that have got to be addressed. And there's a political crisis. I mean, the government is not seen as very legitimate. It's got an armed rebellion in the north. It's got a massive civil disobedience movement in the south. And even within the areas in which there's no rebellion, it's seen as sort of on its last gasp. There needs to be a political opening. There needs to be the incorporation of wider political forces in Yemen into the government. That's a Yemeni question, and the United States can't be seen as forcing itself in that issue. It's got to be solved by Yemenis, but it's got to be in partnership. It can't be solved by Yemen alone either. Right?
Mm-hmm.
It's got to be a cooperative relationship with the United States, with the Gulf states, with the European states. It's got to be very much an international effort in reviving Yemen.
In terms of the United States' role, we already have Afghanistan and Pakistan and other places, and Iraq on our plates. How do we take on Yemen?
Well, a lot of people, and there's a lot of talk right now, and I don't quite know where it's coming from, that, you know, in terms of this is the new front and that we're going
right.
to intervene militarily. I don't think that's going to happen. I don't think the Americans have any intention of doing that. And certainly the Yemenis have been very forcibly saying that we don't want direct intervention of the Americans in the regime. It's not at that level. There has to be a concerted effort. We're already there. We built a Coast Guard. We're helping with Border Patrol in the north. We're helping with surveillance. We're helping with, training of anti-terrorism forces, kind of SWAT teams, this kind of stuff. We're helping with intelligence. We have a very active support, but not direct involvement. And I think that's the way to go. I think definitely that's the way to go with this. It's not a question of getting U.S. troops in there. I think getting U.S. troops in there would actually be a negative in a sense of active fighting. There are U.S. troops, and they're there as trainers. But in terms of active fighting, that would not be good because, as I say, it has to be a political solution. And in Yemen, it's very important that the solution be Yemeni.
Right. What about this New York Times report that President Obama ordered two cruise missile attacks in Yemen a few weeks ago? We gave their forces military hardware and intelligence to carry out those attacks.
Those two statements contradict themselves right there. One is we gave them hardware, another is we shot a missile. I don't know. The cruise missile came from a leak in the administration, and I don't know that it was true at all. The Yemenis insist that it was a Yemeni operation, and the United States has sort of been coy about exactly what happened there. And I really don't know what happened there. What we do know is that there were two strikes in Abyan, and one of them in Arhab, I think, in the north, in which something fell on houses that were supposed to have militants in them.
Let's go to Dave from Menominee. Hi, Dave.
Hi, good morning. The leaks, I believe, were from the Pentagon, from what I understand. I wanted to bring up two points. A previous caller came on and said, what was the difference between the Bush administration and the Obama administration? And isn't it true that the system that we have set up is the system that President Bush put in place? Nothing has changed with that system since President Obama has taken office. And also, the caller made a statement about the president is supposed to, number one thing is to protect the people of the United States, and that is absolutely not true. When the president is sworn in, he is sworn in to protect the Constitution of the United States. And I'd like to get your thoughts on both of those.
On what the president is supposed to do. Certainly, protection is an important thing. But yes, you're right. He is sworn to protect the Constitution. But in theory, the Constitution is protecting us. We live by the Constitution. The difference between the Obama and the Bush administration, you said the system. I don't quite know what you mean by the system. If we're talking about Guantanamo, we can certainly go into that issue. But in terms of the Middle East, let me just contrast in Yemen one thing that I think is important. In 2002, the first Hellfire missile strike happened, the U.S., some agency associated with the U.S. government shot a Hellfire missile in the eastern desert and killed and hit a car that had six Yemeni in it and were killed. One of them was actually an American citizen, and who was the head of Al Qaeda in Yemen, or the declared head of Yemen's Al Qaeda, was killed. And that was done in cooperation with the Yemeni. It was a secret operation. And part of the agreement was that that it remained secret, that it just, a car blew up, that's it. But Paul Wolfowitz got up and immediately started trumpeting, saying that we can hit anybody anywhere, that Al-Qaeda is not safe. We can hit anybody anywhere, and admitting that it was an American attack against the express agreement they did with the Yemeni government. And the Yemeni government was furious because, of course, it came out bad for them because, they said it was a violation of the opposition came along, said it was a violation of Yemeni sovereignty. Now, we have a similar situation that just happened, but this time the United States is keeping quiet. They're not saying anything, and they are, they are very much respecting the Yemeni need to preserve the Yemeni government's need to preserve their national sovereignty. It's a very important political principle inside of Yemen. And so, you know, the Yemeni government's been saying, we welcome aid, we welcome training, we welcome weapons, we welcome all these things. But, you know, we will take care of our internal problems. And thus far, the government, the Obama administration, seems to be following that line, which is the smart one, which I think is the way to go here. So in terms of differences, I think that's an important one.
Let's talk a little bit more about Guantanamo. Who, I understand there are about 20 Yemeni prisoners at Guantanamo. Who are they? Do we know?
There's many more than 20.
Are there?
There are, I think it's like, you got to keep counting, but it's something like 90 or something.
Oh.
About 40% of the population.
Really?
Yes. Well, that's an interesting story. And there I would agree with the gentleman that just called that Obama hasn't changed the system much. It's too hot a political potato for Obama, and he has sort of made tiny little adjustments. But basically it is the Bush system that's in place in Guantanamo. That's a huge issue. It goes much beyond Guantanamo. It's an issue that, you know, sort of surrounds the whole issue of security that's been on everybody's mind here and the U.S. role in fighting, you know, terrorists throughout the world. The Bush administration pushed a new paradigm. There were problems with it, and those problems have not been solved. We haven't worked that issue out at all. In Guantanamo, there was at the peak there was about 680 folks down there, and the largest nationalities were Afghani, followed by Saudi, and then Yemeni. When the Supreme Court in 2004 ruled that the prisoners there had habeas rights, they could petition the courts to review their detention, the basis of the detention, the Bush administration itself started, you know, closing the base, in the sense they started sending a lot of the folks back to their home countries. These are political decisions. Any citizen that came from a Western country, from Europe or from Australia, they were repatriated immediately. The European countries did not agree with the Bush administration on their policies in Guantanamo, and they demanded the repatriation of their citizens, and their citizens were repatriated. Then in the third world, you know, places like Saudi Arabia, Afghanistan, Morocco, Egypt, they started sending the prisoners back with kind of an agreement that the domestic security in Saudi Arabia or in Morocco or in whatever country would keep a watch on these people. And so many of the people who were not considered dangerous were there maybe for intelligence value, but were never going to be charged with a crime. And were not thought to be a real threat. Those people were repatriated. And so the population went way, way down. The population now is about 200 or something like this. That didn't happen with the Yemeni because the U.S. government didn't trust that the Yemeni government could keep tabs on them. And the Yemeni government publicly was saying, look, you know, what's the basis upon which these men are being held? We want these detainees back in our country. If the United States has evidence that they have violated the law, then we will try them in Yemeni courts and deal with them as Yemeni law says. Once again, the issue of, you know, national sovereignty, they're very proud of that. And so the Yemenis, who were not considered dangerous, were not released. And so as all the other populations went down, the Yemenis became the largest proportion. In 2008, the Boumediene decision, the detainees, the prisoners in Guantanamo, were finally given habeas rights. There was lots of back and forth between Congress and et cetera, et cetera. Finally, 2008, they were given habeas rights. Their cases started to hit after Obama came into the White House. Their cases started to hit the federal courts in D.C., and there were quite a number of them amongst the Yemenis that the administration knew that it would lose. That even by their definition of who should be in Guantanamo, which is a supporter, a substantial supporter of al-Qaeda, there were about 40 of them that they said, you know, we got to get these guys out of here. And they were told they would be released. They were put on a list to be released. But it was very difficult politically for Obama to do this, and particularly when there were two former Guantanamo detainees who were Saudi, and they got out of Saudi Arabia and went down to Yemen. They founded this new joint Saudi-Yemeni branch of Al-Qaeda, and they've been causing major problems. And so everybody says, you can't release the Yemeni detainees, and it became a political hot potato. The Yemeni detainees in Guantanamo are a huge political hot potato. They're a political hot potato between the Democrats and the Republicans, and they're also a hot potato between the Yemeni government and the Americans.
Right, and keeping Guantanamo from being closed sooner rather than later, right?
Yeah. You know, once again, it's political, and so closing the base is, you know, very much something that the Obama administration wants to do as a political act. It is not, by the way, undoing Bush's policies on detainment. For example, little known, Obama put through a Military Commissions Act of 2009 that modified the Military Commissions Act of 2006, which is very much in line with sort of the Bush philosophy that there is this different set of laws that should be used in trying terrorism suspects. So that would take place in Illinois, for example. If they moved them there, they would still be using this alternative law that is a product of the Bush administration. So, you know, though the political value of closing the base for the rest of the world, the legal issues are still very much alive, regardless of where they are.
Let's go to Habu from Madison. Hello, Habu.
Yes, hello, and thank you. This is a very illuminating conversation you're having with a very good guest.
Thank you.
Thank you.
A couple of things have been missed out. One is that I just heard, actually, in fact, was it yesterday on the Canadian service, where they were talking to an editor of a newspaper in Sanaa, and he said that this drone missile attack actually killed something like about 70 to 80 people. This is kind of in the same line of what we are doing in Pakistan, that for one or two people, you know, we kill 70 people, 80 people, and you know, we are insouciant about it. That's one part. The second part is that the Houthis in the north, who are fighting for their rights, as I believe, have been able to knock off Saudi air power jets and Yemeni jets, and that tells me that there's a there's quite a bit of sophistication in what these ragtag Houthis are doing. And the last part is that the United States apparently is going to be now occupying the island of Socotra, which is on the Persian Gulf, and with an air base. And I'm just kind of befuddled. What do we need an air base if we are going ostensibly to fight Al-Qaeda in Yemen? What do we need an air base for, unless it is to police the sea lanes or for any future engagement with Iraq? And I mean engagement, I mean military engagement with Iraq with Iran, I'm sorry. So those are my questions, and
all
thank
right.
you.
Great points. Thanks, Habu.
That's a very, very informed
yes.
I would say that on the first issue, it's a very good one. When the missile strike happened, yes, it killed the one in Chabwa killed some, you know, 50 to 60 to 70. We're not exactly sure how many folks, we're not exactly sure who was killed in it either. The target was a major Al Qaeda leadership meeting. It appears that the top leaders and Al-Awlaki was not there. It was Al-Awlaki's house that was hit. This is a very interesting question because the tribe in which the bomb, the region that the place was hit, they said, you know, why is it that the Yemeni government is dropping bombs in our head? They didn't say the Americans. They said, why is it that the Yemeni government is dropping bombs in our head? If these people are terrorists, if they have violated laws, you know, bring in the police and give them a trial. You know, give us some evidence. you are killing them without any trial. You're killing them without any due process. This is a very typical Yemeni response to this kind of thing. They're very much into, you know, sort of due process and the law and sovereignty. What the tribe said, and see, this is in the Southern Governance, they said, this is just like the Yemeni government's treatment of the demonstrators in Aden and in Lahej and in Radfan and in Dalia. These are peaceful demonstrators, and they're being shot at by the police. This is the repressive tactics of the Yemeni regime. And that's where a tactic may exacerbate some of the already existing political problems that are happening in Yemen. And, you know, Yemen is a country in which there is a fair amount of autonomy of tribal groups and whatnot, and they have to bring, this is where it shares some similarities with Afghanistan, the outside tribal groups, they have to be brought into the political process. The tribes are kind of like mini states, and they have their own interests. They're not ideological. They're a social and a kin group, and they have to be brought into the political process. And the Yemeni government kind of uses tribal conflicts to rule. In other words, they'll ally with certain tribes against others. Of course, the ones that are on the outs, they will, for example, support the Houthis. Or, if Al-Qaeda gets in there, they will protect them. They'll say, you know, the government's just being a big bully. And why are they being a big bully? And so we have to be very careful about the kinds of tactics that are used and the kinds of interventions. As for the Houthis in the north, this is an interesting conflict. Yes, they have performed very well militarily. This is the sixth iteration. It appears to be coming to its close. They're talking about there is some mediation. And it appears that we may see a winding down of that conflict, the sixth round of that conflict since 2004. The government, of course, says that they are backed by the Iranians and by Hamas and et cetera, et cetera. Hezbollah, most analysts say that that's not the case. They're just very effective fighters. And it is true that they've been able to hold off the Yemeni army. Even though the Yemeni army tried scorched earth tactics to destroy them, they couldn't really do it. And the Saudis intervened, and the Saudis got their nose bloodied as well in the conflict. So they have been very good fighters. The third part of the thing in Socotra. I have not heard about that. I have not heard about the air base. I would be interested in finding the source of that. Yemen is very much, the Yemeni government would very much like to cooperate with the United States. I know that when the pirate question happened, the Yemenis offered that the International Center for the Monitoring of Piracy, which is in Malaysia, I believe, or Indonesia, it's in the Malacca Straits, that it be moved to Socotra, that it be a new international operating base for monitoring piracy. But Yemen very much wants to participate in the modern world, and it welcomes international investments in its country. The air base, I don't know. We have bases, of course, in Saudi Arabia. We have military bases in Djibouti. I'm not quite sure what the need would be there. But I know that the Yemeni government, as long as they could sort of justify it, would very much like the investment. I know that much. I'll have to look into that. That's an interesting question.
We'll take more phone calls. If you'd like to join us in a moment, our guest this hour, as we learn a great deal about Yemen, is Professor Charles Schmitz. He is in the Department of Geography at Towson University in Baltimore, is a specialist in Yemen, has written extensively about the country, reflections on Guantanamo and American efforts for political reform in the Arab world, the legal battle for Guantanamo. And we're welcoming phone calls because Yemen, of course, has been much in the news in the last few weeks since the attempted bombing of the plane in Detroit on Christmas Day. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Lines are open if you'd like to join the conversation. 800-486-8655. Or you can send an email if you'd like. That address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program today, the author of Harry Truman's Excellent Adventure, the true story of a great American road trip. Hard to believe that shortly after he left the presidency, he and his wife Bess got into his new Chrysler. Harry loved cars. He packed the Chrysler himself and did the unpacking in the various places they stayed around the country. He undertook a journey that a lot of us make every year, but after all, the guy was the former president. He had no Secret Service protection. He actually had no money, and he kept a record of where he stopped to buy gasoline, where he stayed, and what the response was, as you can imagine, once people realized that it was Harry Truman who was staying at the motel. The author of the book actually retraced the steps of Harry and Bess, and it's a thoroughly entertaining and very informative book about his presidency and his relationship with Dean Acheson and Eisenhower and Nixon and Kennedy and Johnson, and the list goes on. If you'd like to join our conversation about Yemen, our phone number is 800-486-8655. I just want to spend a few more moments on Guantanamo, Professor Schmitz. The president, President Obama, has said that certainly our treatment of prisoners and holding them for a long period of time in Guantanamo has been a recruiting tool. You mentioned the formation of an al-Qaeda unit in Yemen, and I'm wondering if it has been a recruiting tool, the holding of the number of prisoners there are at Guantanamo from Yemen for such a long period of time. Has that sparked more of a movement in Yemen or not?
No, I wouldn't say that it's that direct. I would say that al-Qaeda's growth in Yemen is very much a domestic issue, a domestic regional issue, because, when the Saudis made some effective raids, the folks from Saudi Arabia came and they said, well, Yemen would be a better base of operation. And when was it last? I think it was last fall, they sent a suicide bomber who got very close to killing the deputy interior ministry inside of Saudi Arabia. And this sort of was, implementing their vision of becoming a regional base of operations. And I think their attempt to bomb a plane in the United States is an attempt to sort of put them in the foreground of al-Qaeda's, campaign of terror. I think they came because they knew that the Yemen was vulnerable. They knew that, that there's the rebellion in the north. There's a lot of discontent with the government. The economic situation was deteriorating, and they thought that they could find both ideological and, sort of political niches that they could occupy, and it seems that they have. And so I would say that's the main factor. In terms of Guantanamo, I mean, that's an irritant throughout the Arab world because, what's the opposite of terror? It's sort of the rule of law, it looks like an American superpower is simply making up the law because it can. In other words, might makes right. That's the thing that's irritating about Guantanamo.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say it's a particular, it's an irritant for everybody, and it's an example. You get a lot in Yemen. Al-Qaeda says that, the Arab regimes are only there, they're puppet regimes of the American government, and that the goal of the American government is to control the area and to keep, Muslims down, to keep Muslims oppressed. If you see a policy like Guantanamo, it kind of feeds that thing. But there are many, many other examples. I mean, there was talk in Yemen when the international forces went in to fight the pirates, that they were there to, take over the region. You constantly hear this, that, it's the old imperialists are coming back, the Brits are coming back, the Americans are coming back, and they've got designs to take over the world and take over the region. And so it's only in that context that it becomes an irritant.
We have about a minute left, a little less than that. Joe from Madison, hi.
Oh, hi. Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. And
sure, Joe.
I just called and wondered why on earth matches and lighters are still allowed on planes when you can't use them on the planes anywhere, or for that matter, usually you can't use them in the airports. And it's to please the smokers and others, perhaps, but there's a lot of people who are very concerned about having that on the planes.
I didn't know they were allowed on planes.
Yes, they are.
Okay. Do you want to comment on that, Professor?
I don't have. I'm not a TSA policymaker. I have
no idea. It's probably not a good idea, though. I think we can agree on that. It should be policy. Well, you've been a wealth of information. Thank you so much for being with us. I learned a great deal this hour. Thanks.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Our guest this hour, Professor Charles Schmitz. He is a, as you can tell from listening to him, a specialist on Yemen, written extensively about the country and United States' relationship with Yemen. He's in the Department of Geography at Towson University in Baltimore, and special interests, the political economy of development and developmental policy in the Arab world, international law, and the war on terror. His most recent publication is Yemeni Reflections on Guantanamo and American Efforts for Political Reform in the Arab World. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to Leave It to Rhonda. She finds the Yemen expert in the country. That's great. Thanks to John Treader for on-air production here in our studios in snowy downtown Milwaukee. We're finally getting the snow that we missed the last go-around. Harry Truman's excellent adventure coming up.